Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On Wednesday, North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile, ending a two-month pause in its testing and reigniting tensions between Washington and Pyongyang. The missile reached about 2,800 miles into space, 10 times the distance to the International Space Station, and 620 miles eastward, landing in the Sea of Japan. Bottom line, it showed that North Korea has the ability to launch a missile that could travel the necessary distance to hit the eastern seaboard of the United States. President Trump had this response.
As you probably have heard, and some of you have reported, a missile was launched a little while ago from North Korea. I will only tell you that we will take care of it. We have General Mattis in the room with us, and we've had a long discussion on it. It is a situation that we will handle.
Meanwhile, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee continue to digest the substance of hearings held on November 14th to consider just how much power should rest with the president when it comes to launching nuclear weapons. Joining us is Dakota Rudisill. He's a law professor at Ohio State's Moritz College of Law, where he teaches and writes about nuclear weapons issues. Dakota has worked on nuclear issues throughout his 20 years as a national security professional, including as a senior U.S. Senate staff member and at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
What about the protocol? Can you give us a thumbnail on what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So the U.S. nuclear command and control system, as it exists right now, is basically a product of two things during the Cold War. Number one was a desire to have the release of nuclear weapons and the control of nuclear weapons centralized with a civilian to reflect civilian control of the armed forces and not allow lower echelon people within the military to be able to cross the nuclear threshold on their own. So that's one. The second impetus that the system reflects is, frankly, the reality of the intercontinental ballistic missile, a missile that can fly from one side of the planet to the other and deliver a nuclear weapon in, depending on the launch point, somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes. And so that you put those two elements together and you get our nuclear command control system, which is, number one, it has a person, a civilian, the president of the United States, in a central decision-making position. And second, it is rigged for speed. The entire system is designed to allow the president of the United States to be able to make a decision about launching nuclear weapons and that decision to be transmitted to missile crews and those missiles to be released before incoming Soviet or today Russian warheads would detonate and destroy our forces on the ground. And so it is, again, it has a human and it's fast.
Does it stop a detonation?
An incoming detonation?
Yeah.
No, the nuclear command and control system is really about the question of
retaliation
of U.S. nuclear weapons. So it could be a U.S. retaliatory strike, or it is also designed to allow the president to launch a preemptive strike if it looks like an adversary is about to strike first against the United States. The system would potentially allow for the United States to strike first to destroy the enemy forces on the ground.
There's all kinds of movies out there about that 30-minute period and what someone on a nuclear submarine is going, what they're going through once they get the order, right?
Yeah.
What actually, so the president pushes a button, it triggers what kind of action where? We never know where, right?
So let me just talk a little bit about, kind of on a more practical level, how the president is involved in nuclear command and control. So based on the public record, I mean, we've never had an unclassified briefing that opens what's called the football. So there's a military aide who is never more than just a few feet from the president. This is not a decision maker military aide. This is a lower ranking person, an officer, and carries with this person what's called the nuclear football. It's a black briefcase. Some people have said it weighs about 50 or 60 pounds. Huh. It has communications gear. It has what's called the Black Book. The Black Book then has a list of nuclear employment options. It's just like a menu. The president then has what's called the biscuit, which is a card that the president carries at all times, which has codes specific to the president of the United States. So in the event that employment of nuclear weapons was contemplated, the football would be opened. The president would presumably be on a secure conference call with the Secretary of Defense, probably the four-star commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, the four-star commander of NORAD, probably the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president would get a very quick briefing about what the security situation was. Is there a missile in the air? Has there been a nuclear detonation? Does it look like some entity, some foreign state, is about ready to attack the United States? The president then would have a matter of minutes, and it just depends on the scenario, anywhere from 1 or 2 minutes, perhaps 10 minutes more, but still a very short timeline. If we're talking about a major exchange scenario between major nuclear powers, to make a decision. The president then would make a decision. Based on the public record, it sounds like there's some role for the Secretary of Defense potentially to authenticate that order by the president, which simply means this was the president who made it. It's not a second vote by the Secretary mm-hmm. of Defense on whether nuclear weapons should be employed. Mm-hmm. And at that point then, the president's order is transmitted to the Pentagon and then on to missile and submarine crews.
But at that point, the Secretary of State could invalidate it, choose not to authorize
the
it.
The Secretary of Defense could—
I'm sorry, Secretary of Defense.
Secretary
yeah.
of Defense could, in theory, not authenticate the order
and
from the president.
And what would happen
the
then?
We would have a constitutional crisis, the likes of which we've never seen.
Yeah.
And again, I want to emphasize the way the system is set up right now is for the Secretary of Defense and the senior military leadership that I've mentioned to provide information and advice to the president. But as the system is set up right now, it is only the president that makes a decision, and it is the Secretary of Defense which potentially authenticates that it was the president who made the decision, not that this is the right call in the situation and not that it's legal.
Why do they refer to the president in this instance as a civilian? His title, his or her title in the future, is Commander-in-Chief.
So Commander-in-Chief is the phrase which appears in the Constitution.
Right.
So the Constitution created this office of the president where none existed before and made this person the head of state, the chief executive, and also Commander-in-Chief of the armed forces. The framers did not explain what was meant by Commander-in-Chief. It's become a matter of enormous debate among historians and legal scholars what this means because the framers at the time didn't say much about it. At the minimum, what it means is that the president is at the apex of the command structure of the U.S. Armed Forces. That does not necessarily mean that the president is free from having to follow the law.
And then let's get back to the nuclear submarine out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some commander on a submarine that's going to have to be the one to push the real button, right?
Presumably, that's right. Again, based on the public record, so after the president makes a decision, it's transmitted to the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon. And then what's called an EAM, an emergency action message, then is sent out to whatever forces the president decides to use. Let's
right.
say it's a submarine, like you say.
Or a silo somewhere, yeah.
Right. So the message goes out, and there's less clarity at that point in the public record exactly how that process unfolds. But if it is a properly authenticated message from the president of the United States, at that point they have authority to release nuclear weapons and would do so very quickly.
You know— We haven't really had this conversation in many, many years, it feels like. I have an old Lazarus toy catalog from Christmas from the 50s that has ICBMs as toys because it was that much of a part of our culture. It doesn't feel like it's part of our culture anymore. From where you sit, how does it feel to be talking about this right now?
Well, so I would just go back to what Senator Bob Corker, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said at the outset of the hearing that
on November 14th.
The recent hearing that you mentioned, he noted that Congress has not had a hearing on nuclear command and control since the 1970s. You know, as you indicate, it's just not been on the radar. But it is again now because we are currently in a nuclear crisis with North Korea. China is significantly expanding their nuclear forces. U.S. forces are being modernized. I would say, if anything, the chances of actual employment of a nuclear weapon today are significantly higher than they've been for decades, and I would argue probably higher than they were during the Cold War.
And what has changed over those decades when it comes to the technology? Can you talk about that?
Well, U.S. nuclear forces have been modernized a bit since the Cold War, but you know, mainly what we've got now are the best of U.S. nuclear forces during the Cold War, again, with some updates, but it's essentially the same force. The Russians have a kind of a modernized version of their Cold War force. What's different today is that you've got North Korea, which is a new nuclear state, and they have, you know, they've tested nuclear weapons now a number of times underground. They're testing missiles. Yesterday we had their test of a missile, which the Secretary of Defense says could reach anywhere on the planet. And so now there's increased risk of a conflict that might go nuclear. But that's a very different thing than what we were talking about during the Cold War. In the Cold War, the risk was that the greatest concern of all of us, right, was that you'd have a global thermonuclear war with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons used and potentially the end of human civilization. Mm-hmm. Today, the risk is more employment of one or two or three, a small number of nuclear weapons by North Korea or by the United States. Because the deterrence relationship between the United States and North Korea is less settled, is less clear, the parameters are less established, greater risk of use of nuclear weapons than during the Cold War, where you had a very, very robust deterrence relationship with the Soviet Union, and it would only collapse in, you know, a moment of just obviously catastrophic failure of people and politics.
Why the Senate hearings on November 14th? I say hearing. I mean, it was one day. Are they done? And why now?
So why now? I think that you just go to the remarks of some of the senators at the hearing. Some of them raised concern about the personality we have as commander in chief. The president was described as impulsive,
And these are Republicans.
So mainly Democrats were saying
okay.
this, but Senator Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican of
obviously they're not a friend of the president's.
Not currently a friend. That's right. I mean, he's expressed his concern on the record that the president is leading us into World War III. And you talk to a lot of Republicans in Washington who have been around a long time in the national security world. They will express concerns such as the president seems to be trying to bait North Korea into a war and doesn't completely understand what that would entail.
Another piece of this is the head of, you know, the leader of North Korea is a pretty much unknown quantity how he'll react.
He's a new leader. He's only been leading North Korea for about 5 or 6 years now. He's young.
Mm-hmm.
He is the third member of the Kim dynasty now to rule North Korea. It's basically a hereditary kingdom under this Kim dynasty. He is plainly emotional. He is very, very concerned with his own reputation, perceptions of North Korea. He seems to be very insecure. One thing that he has in common with his two predecessors, Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, is everything he does seems to suggest that he believes that North Korea must be a nuclear state. And so I think that what we're hearing from some people in the United States government and other people in the United States that our goal is to denuclearize North Korea, to get them to give up nuclear weapons. Most of the North Korea experts I know, I mean, actually, I would say all of the North Korea experts I know believe that North Korea would never voluntarily give up nuclear weapons.
That's Dakota Rudisill. He's assistant professor at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. And he's worked on nuclear issues throughout his 20 years as a national security professional, including with the Senate, with the Obama administration, and also with the not on those issues, but is also a consultant for the United States Supreme Court. Coming up, we're going to hear from the Jim Carafano. He's another expert, another point of view. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump, like every president before him, or at least everyone since there's been nuclear power out there, has sole authority over the use of nuclear weapons. Because of that, remarks he made in August gave people around the world purpose to pause.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Now, Congress, at least a Senate committee, is mulling a plan to rein in presidential power over the nuclear arsenal. We're talking about the president and the bomb in light of the most recent ballistic missile test by North Korea. Still with us is national security expert and Ohio State Law professor Dakota Rudisill. Joining us by phone, Vice President for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, James Carafano. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, good to be with you.
We chatted off air about your 25-year military career, which included working with nuclear weapons, right at the border with North Korea.
Yeah, my first job in the Army was at a unit called Weapons Support Detachment Korea, and our war plan was is if the war broke out with North Korea. Back then, we had tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea, and we didn't give nuclear weapons to the South Koreans. The plan was is we would marry up with the South Korean units, put the nuclear weapons in their artillery, and then fire them at the North. So I've been dealing with this stuff for a really long time.
The president didn't repeat in his most recent remarks this fire and fury stuff. What are we to make of his rhetoric when it comes to North Korea? What sort of signals is he sending? It feels very different than any president previously, Republican or Democrat.
Yeah, I think we overemphasize the rhetoric. The North Koreans don't pay that much attention to it. We're on some kind of escalatory path, which I completely disagree with. I completely disagree that this is a crisis. I actually think this is actually very predictable where it's going. And I actually think the rhetoric's had very little, if any, impact on the escalatory ladder between North Korea and the United States. The North Koreans don't just listen to President Trump's tweets and squeaks, just like we just don't literally take North Korea's, you know, tweaks and yells seriously, where they do things like saying, well, we're going to vaporize Washington, D.C. North Koreans actually talk to a lot of what's called NGOs. Matter of fact, my analyst on North Korea actually meets with the North Korean officials usually a couple of times a year. They have back channels with the U.S. government. So they are looking at the context of all of U.S. policy. They're not just reacting to tweets. So anybody who's essentially measuring what's going on by what the two leaders are yelling at each other, they find that very sophomoric and juvenile.
Well, okay, understood as far as that goes. But once again, we've never had a president make these kinds of statements before. What are we to take seriously? What messages should we take from the president? Not the president, then. It shouldn't come.
Yeah, we should take seriously is what the North Koreans take seriously, which is what actual U.S. policy is.
An actual U.S. policy does give the president the power to, you know, open up the football and start the process.
Right. So, but that's not the only element of U.S. strategy. And I think we have to put all this in context, which explains why, one, we're not in a crisis mode, and why a review of presidential power, as if you did think we're in a crisis mode, would be unnecessary, because we're not. So U.S. strategy includes nuclear deterrence, but it also includes missile defense, which is the capacity to shoot the enemy missile down, which lessens the necessity to kind of put your finger on a hair trigger. Conventional deterrence with South Korea and Japan and political isolation and pressure. So those things in context are what the North Koreans are facing. And if you look at the conflict from everybody's perspective, people look at this as like, because the rhetoric is going up and down, and because every time something happens, people think we're an escalatory ladder. I don't think we're on a linear path. Matter of fact, if you think of escalation like a ladder, with nuclear war at the top, there's all kinds of rungs missing, and really no country knows how to bridge those rungs. So North Korea doesn't have an interest in a war, because the whole purpose of having nuclear weapons is to ensure regime survival, that nobody will mess with their regime. And the one thing North Korea knows is that if a war actually started, the first thing that would happen would be the regime would disappear. So they don't want a war. Hmm. South Korea doesn't want a war because they would take literally hundreds of thousands of casualties in the first few days. China doesn't want a war. They don't want to deal with a failed North Korea, nor do they want to see the U.S. or South Korea encroach on their northern boundary. We don't want a war. We can protect and secure our interests without one, because our interests are, one, there's not a war, and two, that North Korea can't directly threaten the United States. So the notion that somehow we're on a crisis scenario, I simply don't see that as true.
Dakota Russo?
Yeah, so I would agree that there are a lot of escalatory steps between where we are right now and a full-out, full war with North Korea. But I really have to disagree about the idea that we are not in a crisis. I think plainly when you have another country with nuclear weapons threatening to launch missiles near U.S. territory, on a number of occasions we've had very senior people within the North Korean government talk about doing an atmospheric detonation of a nuclear weapon in the Pacific. And when you have the rhetoric flying around as it is right now, I think we are just on the face of it in a crisis, and I don't think we know exactly where this goes. I would agree that I don't think North Korea wants a full war because they would not survive it. I would hope I don't think that the United States certainly wants a full war because it'd be just horrifically damaging to U.S. troops in South Korea, civilians in South Korea, obviously non-combatants in North Korea. It'd just be a terrible event. But there's a lot between where we are and a full war, which could include an atmospheric test by North Korea. It could include smaller exchanges that are conventional. It could include smaller uses of nuclear weapons. So I think that there's a lot of reason, frankly, to be alarmed.
Yeah, I just think that's incredibly simplistic analysis. It's like watching a movie and just listening to the sound, and you're not paying attention to anything else. I mean, what you've picked is just kind of the inflammatory parts of that out of the context of the whole rest of the strategic relationship. So I just find your analysis just completely incredible. Sorry.
If the current situation is taken out of the equation at this point, you feel comfortable with the level of presidential power when it comes to deploying nuclear weapons. Jim Carafano?
Well, first, I would say we have a lot of evidence for that. This command and control procedure has been in place for many decades through real crises and through all kinds of presidents. So we don't have any credible history to suggest that there's any flaws in the current system. That's one. There's also no credible argument that, in a sense, that how this president is less qualified than any previous president to have the authority that he has.
No credible argument, really?
Well, yeah, absolutely. There is no credible argument. I mean, you know, people don't like how he tweets. People don't like other things, but people haven't liked the character of other presidents as well. That you are literally talking about questioning the legal authorities that were established in the Constitution of the United States because this president doesn't act and sound like other previous presidents. That's not a foundation of a serious discussion.
Well, I guess you could always say that were the founding fathers visualizing or envisioning something like nuclear power.
So let's go back to why. First of all, it is U.S. policy that we retain the right to first use, right? So it's not just that if somebody fires a nuclear weapon at us that we'll fire back. We actually retain the right to initiate a nuclear exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we do that? It's not because we're an aggressive power. It's because we think that strengthens the resilience of the deterrent, that people know that even a conventional attack on the United States could preempt a horrific response. Why does the president have the authority to respond? It's to again, deter enemies, that they understand that if they fire a nuclear weapon at us, we might immediately fire back. I mean, the longest time that you would have if somebody actually launched an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM at the United States, would be about 30 minutes or so, which would leave actually very, very little time for any kind of consultative process. Now, What that's in place for, it's to tell enemies that it's very unlikely that you could pull off a surprise strike against the United States. So all these things have been put in place not to enable you know, any reckless person that wants to push a button, but to do exactly the opposite, to send messages to our enemy that our deterrent is powerful and responsive. The whole notion of doing this is to make the likelihood of nuclear war less, not more. The problem with a lot of the analysis that I've heard in this discussion is the presumption that people think that our officials or our policymakers or our generals or anybody thinks of nuclear weapons as warfighting tools. It's exactly the opposite. Those tools are there not to be used.
Mm-hmm.
And the credibility is in demonstrating the capability to protect and defend yourself. You are telling your enemies, don't try this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the president and the bomb, presidential powers when it comes to nuclear warfare. You just heard from James Carafano. He's vice president for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Doesn't think it's necessary for Congress to reconsider those presidential powers. Also with us, Dakota Rudisill. He's a law professor at Ohio State and also a national security expert who's consulted with different branches of government. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dakota Rudisill.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add, so I completely agree with the point that James made about the deterrent power of the president of the United States being able to give an order for the employment of nuclear weapons and for that order to be executed in a very prompt fashion.
Because I can respond so quickly, that's a deterrent. Okay.
Yeah, I strongly agree with that. But going back to where we started this conversation, the U.S. nuclear command and control structure was designed for the Cold War context and, frankly, for any other sort of emergency where a very, very rapid presidential decision had to be made. A separate question, which came out at the hearing by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is whether some additional procedures or checks might be appropriate on first use of a nuclear weapon by the United States, where the United States is not facing missiles in the air, not facing an imminent attack. And I think that that's a very reasonable conversation to have.
But Jim, you're saying it's very unlikely that the United States has nuclear weapons to deter, not to embark.
Yeah, it's difficult to conceive of a scenario where there would be some kind of imminent requirement for first use where the president would just want to willy-nilly decide, well, we're just going to use a nuclear weapon, and that it wouldn't be done in the context of some larger debate that we would have about war powers in general, where the Congress can always weigh in if they choose to speak with the president. So I we've created this incredibly unrealistic scenario in order to justify doing something that's, I think, unnecessary. Also, the whole notion of not constraining first use, again, is what you don't want is create opportunities for enemies to think that I can steal a march on the United States, maybe launch a nuclear weapon and accomplish something. So if there is some kind of mandatory consultative process in place, and you started that process, right, what an enemy might decide is, oh, my God, the United States is going to attack us with nuclear weapons. Therefore, let's shoot our nuclear weapons first. So actually creating this process might actually inadvertently trigger a nuclear war. Or a president would be eternally deterred because, oh, my God, if I started this consultative process, even if I didn't want to do it and I just wanted the authority because I might need it later, it might trigger a world war. So there's all kinds of unintended consequences here. But the whole notion of first use is to deter enemies. And so needlessly adding in processes, which should in the end be destabilizing, without A, any evidence, historical evidence that there's a problem, B, any real evidence that there's a problem with this president, and C, that there's no likelihood that these authorities would ever be needed or requested, with all the other issues and challenges that we have in the world today, I'm sorry, this to me just smacks of something that people have ginned up because they just don't like this president. It's just something to argue about, as opposed to something that's a real substantive issue.
Dakota Rudisill?
The concern that James raises about Congress imposing process requirements on the president, which would slow nuclear decision-making to a point that an enemy could exploit, is obviously a very real issue. I would note, however, that the leading proposal by folks in Congress who do want to impose such process requirements, and that is H.R. 669 and S-200 by Congressman Liu and by Senator Markey, explicitly on its face says that additional so, for example, the additional requirement of getting a declaration of war from Congress, and there's another proposal out there from a couple professors at Columbia to require a Secretary of Defense second vote, an Attorney General second vote, if you will, on legality. All of these very explicitly accept a situation in which the United States is under attack or imminently under attack. These would only apply to a situation in which first use of nuclear weapons by the United States is contemplated, where there is not an immediate, you know, in the next 30 to 45 minutes threat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so here's where we agree. I mean, we both agree that we're not in, and where I think you're absolutely right, we're not in the Cold War nuclear context anymore, and we should recognize that. But again, here's my concern is when you create a consultative process, even entering into that consultative process might actually spark a nuclear crisis, which is a bad idea. So while you're creating another opportunity to essentially create indecision that might actually lead to nuclear war, that doesn't actually work for me. And the other thing, again, is where you're absolutely right. This isn't the Cold War anymore. We are in a different age of nuclear strategy. We have gone from massive retaliation or mutually assured destruction to what's called a protect and defend mode, or some people call it, back in the old days, they called it damage limitation, which is we have missile defenses as well as a nuclear deterrent. And with a country like a North Korea or Iran, which might have a very, very limited capacity, and we potentially could have a very robust missile defense capacity to counter that.
Virtually unlimited, right?
Right. Yeah, and so let's say in an incredibly unlikely scenario, for whatever reason, that North Korea fired a nuclear missile at Japan or South Korea or the United States. With missile defense, in under the old Cold War context, you would have no other option but to immediately drop a nuclear weapon on them or just accept the strike. In a protect and defend strategy, you have the capacity to shoot that missile down, and then you have capacity to kind of call a timeout and say, okay, do we need to respond in a nuclear fashion? Maybe this was an inadvertent launch. You have a pause there. So we're actually moving towards a more stable nuclear environment, not a less stable nuclear environment. So we're creating mechanisms which are necessarily and potentially destabilizing and aren't really appropriate for the kind of nuclear environment that we're going to deal with. And this is a more complicated because we have the Irans and if Iran develops a nuclear capability and the North Koreas of the world, the protect and defense strategy is very adequate and far more stabilizing. On the other hand, with a larger arsenal like Russia or China, we are still in a scenario of kind of a mutual deterrence, and that's actually proven quite stable.
Dakota, just a few seconds.
Yeah, so I just say that James has outlined the theory of missile defense, and it's certainly very attractive, and the United States is pursuing it and should continue to do that. I would note that a number of weapons testers and a lot of technical experts have looked at the U.S. missile defense system and said that it is certainly not to a point yet where it would be highly reliable. And so still very much we could find ourselves in a situation. Obviously, we're talking about an extreme situation of a North Korean missile attack of some sort, where the missile defenses did not successfully intercept it, and we still need to, at that point, contemplate a very rapid U.S. response.
Yeah, but then your law wouldn't pertain to that situation anyway.
Oh, sir, this is not my law. This is written by two people in Congress.
Fair enough. I am
just your friendly analyst.
Point taken. So the law would actually not help in that situation. And my only counter to that was there are a lot of technical experts who have a lot of confidence in missile defense, and more importantly, the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Russians, and the Iranians, they all take our missile defense seriously.
James Carafano, thanks as always for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me. Great discussion.
James Carafano, Vice President for the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the president and our nuclear warfare. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the president and the bomb this hour. Still with us, national security expert and law professor at OSU, Dakota Rudisill. Joining us now by phone is director of disarmament and threat reduction policy at the Arms Control Association, Kingston Reef. His work focuses on nuclear disarmament, preventing nuclear terrorism, missile defense, and the defense budget. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm just going to take a swing at this and suggest that you support limiting presidential power in terms of access to detonating bombs.
Continuing to vest such destructive power in the hands of one person is undemocratic, irresponsible, unnecessary, and increasingly untenable, in my view. So the answer to your question is yes.
Why increasingly untenable? Because it's worked, as our last guest, Jim Carafano, said, you know, it's worked for decades.
Well, I would dispute that it has worked insofar as there had been a number of close calls over the years during the Cold War whereby, due to an incorrect training tape, for example, placed in the U.S. command and control system, there were chances of a grave miscalculation or understanding. But coming back to the near term, I think there is widespread bipartisan concern about the temperament and personality of the President of the United States. There is concern about statements that he has made vis-a-vis the use of nuclear weapons, comments that he has made in the past alluding to the use of military force or even a preventative strike against North Korea, including, you know, warning that continued North Korean threats would be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. So I think you're seeing a conversation in Washington, in Congress, about what additional responsible checks and balances might be placed on the president's sole authority to order these nuclear weapons.
I want to turn now to a caller, Dr. Peter Mansour. You're on the air. Hi, Dr. Mansour.
Hi, Ann. Great to speak with you again.
Nice to speak with you. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Yeah, so I think James Carafano misses a key point, and that is that our nuclear deterrent, where the president can fire missiles very quickly, is predicated on the idea that the enemy missiles are aimed at our own nuclear force. If those missiles are instead aimed at our cities, and that even if they hit, we still have all the weapons at our disposal to retaliate at a time and place of our own choosing. In other words, there's no reason for a president to make a very quick decision on launching a nuclear weapon if there's only one or two missiles coming at the United States, because they won't take out the nuclear triad. We'll still have the capability to respond whenever we want to.
That is Dr. Peter Mansour. He's chair of military history at Ohio State, where he teaches military history. He's also a colonel, retired with the U.S. Army. Pete, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ann.
Dakota Rudisill?
Yeah, well, so Professor Mansour makes a really, really important point, which is that there are a lot of options for the United States in a number of different scenarios. You know, to go back to the bill that we're talking about here, this Markey-Liu bill, and what Kingston is talking about in terms of imposing some process requirements on the president. You know, the concern here is the human element, that you may have an impulsive decision, you know, by a president of the United States, whoever that person might be, or confusion within within the chain of command, and having a second vote by the Secretary of Defense on the policy issue, by the Attorney General, for example, on the legal issue, or a vote in Congress would add reassurance to that. Now, obviously, there is the time sensitivity question that we're talking about in the Cold War context, or in a situation in which another country, such as North Korea, might be attacking us. You know, which would potentially, you know, make those additional process requirements too cumbersome. But as Professor Mansour just noted, you know, even in such a situation where you have a North Korean nuclear attack by, you know, one or two missiles or something like that, a lack of immediate U.S. response would not necessarily mean that the attack would be successful on us, and would not necessarily mean, as Professor Mansour points out, that we would not have the capability to respond.
Yeah. Kingston Reef?
So I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Mansour and Dr. Rudisell. I mean, the United States currently postures its land-based nuclear forces on a so-called launch under attack posture, meaning that the missiles can be fired within minutes of an order to do so. In our view, that posture is outdated and unnecessary in large part for the reasons that Dr. Mansour just mentioned. You know, U.S. nuclear forces and command and control systems could withstand even a much larger attack than, you know, one or two North Korean nuclear weapons launched at the United States, for example. And given the size and diversity of those forces, the remaining arsenal would be more than sufficient to deliver a devastating response, if that is in fact how we chose to respond. So there is time, and there isn't a need to continue to maintain a posture that is premised on quick, prompt launch.
Peter Mansour, I want to ask you one more question before I let you go, and I do appreciate you calling in. You know, we were talking earlier in the program about rhetoric and what rhetoric means and whether it matters anymore. A lot of people are confused or concerned by the president's remarks, you know, the fury and the fire or whatever it was back in August. They're concerned about similar sorts of rhetoric coming from North Korea. Does it matter anymore? Or is it like what Jim Carafano said, that, no, there's a lot of moving pieces here and the rhetoric is the least of our concerns?
Oh, I think the rhetoric absolutely matters. If you have two leaders, both of whom can launch nuclear weapons without any checks or balances, and they get into, for lack of a better term, a pissing contest with each one another, and they both have very fragile egos, I think it increases the chance of a nuclear launch and a war, one that we could possibly avoid if cooler heads could prevail.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Ann.
Yeah. I want to turn to Greg in Gahanna. Hi, Greg, you're on the air.
Hi there, Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can perfectly.
Okay, great. I just wanted to point out, one of your previous guests mentioned that he believed there was no credible argument for why our current president, you know, would more necessarily require these checks and balances than previous presidents. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, you mentioned the fire and fury rhetoric, mm-hmm. but it was just before he became president, he wondered publicly, he asked aloud, why do we have nuclear weapons if we're not going to use them? So to me, that demonstrates fundamentally, in no uncertain terms, that he doesn't understand that these aren't supposed to be instruments of war. They're supposed to be instruments as deterrents. And, you know, since we have that evidence from his own mouth, it would seem quite logical that we would try and move to put barriers in place.
Hmm. Yeah, Dakota Rudisill.
Yeah, so I would just, you know, I would just say that, you know, there are a lot of people in Washington and in policy circles on both sides of the aisle who are very, very concerned that this president really wants to have a war. And there, you know, I'm not in a position to sit here as
well. We are at war, but you're talking about a traditional type of war.
Yeah, just have a war of some kind,
a nation-state war,
something, right? Something that is a war, that is a big conflict, which focuses attention on the president, puts the president's powers politically and legally at their apex, and is potentially a big victory in this very dramatic big thing. I'm not going to be an armchair psychologist and to try to, you know, assess that or political commentator. But I'd say, you know, when you talk to people in the national security world, again, Democrats, Republicans, independents, people talk about this. And I would just say that's different. I can't recall, certainly in my lifetime, with the exception, I would say, of the post 9/11 period, when obviously there was a lot of impetus for the United States taking military action against the al-Qaeda threat and others related to it. But, you know, I would just say that conversation is out there, and it's those types of concerns which are generating the hearing that we saw a few weeks ago and the legislation that's now in Congress.
Greg, thanks for that call. Kim in Worthington, you're on the air. Kim? Can I get Kim? Hi, Kim, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, I'm a former missile launch officer. I served in the mid-70s, and I just wanted to say that I'm very much in favor of what Congress is proposing in terms of preemptive strike.
Why?
Well, because I served under the only other president I considered unstable enough to potentially get us into a conflict on his own. And I truly believe that this current president is even more unstable.
Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about President Trump and President Nixon.
Okay.
And so, and another thing that has changed since I served is the rise of tactical nuclear weapons, weapons that are mobile, weapons that are carried on submarines,
right,
that can be launched singularly and could cause an escalation if even one of those things is dropped.
Hmm. Kim, thanks for your call.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Kingston Reef, do you want to chime in here? We're just about out of time.
Sure. I think the caller makes some very important points. I mean, I'd like to be able to tell your listeners that we have a system in place that would prevent an impulsive, irrational, or unwise decision by the president of the United States to use nuclear weapons. But unfortunately, that assurance is not something that can be made. And so I think it behooves Congress to continue to have a conversation. It behooves your listeners and the American people to continue to have the conversation about what responsible checks and balances can be put in place on the president's sole authority, and what other changes to current U.S. nuclear policy that emphasizes maintaining weapons at a very high state of readiness, what changes can be made to reduce the potential for miscalculation or unintended use of nuclear weapons as well.
Dakota Rudisill, we're just about out of time. Last word.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention that this is a conversation that we're having here at Ohio State, and we're having it in a very interesting way. I run a major national security crisis simulation here at Ohio State, and I was just delighted that you, Ann, could be part of that as a reporter a few weeks ago. And one of the things that we've done with this crisis simulation is we put our students from a half dozen different programs here at OSU through a crisis scenario involving North Korea in which there's a missile in the air and possibility of use of nuclear weapons. And we've done that for two reasons. Number one, because these are enormously important issues that people need to be thinking about and need to know about. But second, because it's a very stressful situation. And that's just whether or not our students go into national security work, that's just a very valuable thing for them to do, to have a stressful work experience and find their feet as professionals.
And underscore the fact that there are humans involved.
That's right.
Not machines.
That's right.
Kingston Reef, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kingston Reef is the Director of Disarmament and Threat Reduction Policy at the Arms Control Association. And Dakota Rudisill, thanks to you as well. Always appreciate your time today.
Always a pleasure to be here.
That is Dakota Rudisill. He's a professor at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. He is also has worked on nuclear issues throughout his 20 years as a national security professional. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.